Hey everybody, this is Catherine, and you're listening to the Currency with Catherine podcast, the show that teaches you about all things money, but not just money. We approach money through a holistic life lens because all aspects of your life are connected. That's why we bring in other elements like mental health. When you're confident in your financial capability, all other aspects of your life will improve.
Another episode of Currency with Catherine. We got another special guest today. This, just a reminder for everyone, this is starting off our second season of the podcast, and we are not stopping anytime soon. We're going to keep the gas on the pedal. And today we have our special guest is Anuradha, and pronouns are they, them, just to let people know if you get confused slightly off into the show. Just go ahead, put that out there. And I'm just going to turn it over to them. Miss Anuradha, how are you today?
Thank you so much, Catherine. It's so good. I'm good. Excited.
Yes. No, so we're going to jump straight into it. For everyone who's out here, I'm going to put all this information in the show notes, but just want to highlight that Anuradha is a business owner, focuses on capitalism and business, and definitely going to be a special guest because we don't really talk about capitalism. Like when we're business owners and stuff, like we're in it for a buck, but we're not really thinking about the business mindset of it. We're more so about what is something that I can do today to make money. But along with that, there are some problems and challenges and maybe some things that are hampering your business. But I'm talking too much. I'm going to pass the mic over.
No, absolutely. I mean, you're right. A lot of us aren't necessarily thinking in the day to day. We're thinking of the practical survival or thriving or doing our work, right, in some way. But capitalism kind of is underpinning the life, the society, our personal finances, our business finances in a lot of ways that we might be not aware, or that there's often patterns around it that we don't see and don't know about. So that's kind of my work of pointing that out. How did capitalism, how did colonialism impact who we are, how we show up in the world, how we do our work, and how can we unweave that spell that capitalism has written for us?
No, I love it. A lot of people, I wouldn't say it's like our problem, but it's like a lot of people, like especially with the education system, we never learned about capitalism. So would you mind like going deeper into like capitalism and colonialism, and then also tell about what specifically your business does in the space?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. I know that's what I was supposed to answer and I didn't get to that. Yes, my neurodivergent brain forgot. So actually here in the UK, I'm from the US, but I've lived in the UK about 14 years now. And it's actually, according to a law that was passed in the 1980s, talking about anti-capitalism things or so on is illegal. So it's not discussed in regular public education. And we don't address the colonial baggage that the British Empire put on to so much of the world. Right? So we don't even talk about it. In the US, I was a US teacher. I was a science teacher and so on. The erasure of this is not, we don't talk about it. We talk about the world in terms of progress, in terms of white supremacy culture. We don't necessarily name it that, but the dominant culture, that's what that is. So what is capitalism? Well, there's a distinction between capitalism and commerce. The things that when we're doing to trade, make an item, make a product and sell it, and trade services or these kinds of things that we might be doing for dollars or some currency is commerce. The place where it becomes capitalism, so capitalism actually was created a few hundred years ago, and it wasn't a natural progression of society. It was very much codifying rules set out by the elite, especially here in Western Europe, that would start to privatize the land. That was one of the first features, the enclosures. We start to privatize things that are there. And we can think about that now, where besides maybe some library, you know, libraries and footpaths like sidewalks, I'm becoming too British living here, sidewalks are like one of the last places that aren't privatized, right? We can walk on that freely to some degree, right? Without any expense and so on. But so many other places are all privatized, a lot of the land here. So that's one of the features. It's also how we exploit other people's labor. So Karl Marx called that, he called it a primitive accumulation, where we're accumulating the wealth done by other people. And people like Jeff Bezos and so on, what they're doing in mass is the wealth he has is extracted from his hundreds of workers, thousands of workers around the world, doing work at a very deflated wage, not a living wage, not having bathroom breaks, not having all those things that we think should, right, that our labor laws, right, are indicating we shouldn't, the labor unions, right, pushing for change. And yet what these elite people are doing is taking that money and taking that money out of circulation and causing bank runs. I mean, I don't know if you're going to be addressing this sort of thing on your show, but that's what that means. When the exploitation gets too much, then we have mass situations like the credit crunch that happened in 2018, the housing market bubble bursting. That is part of capitalism gone awry.
Wow, like that was a lot, but I got it. And people, make sure y'all are listening to this. So would you say, backing up just a little bit, when you were talking about the exploitation, so would a lot of countries, they necessarily don't have the same labor laws like in the US we do, like you have to at least get like a 30-minute break, or like you can't work over X amount of hours. I think here is 16 hours in the US for certain industries, even as far as like, if you work for like certain residential facilities, like you can only drive for 2 hours. So is that some things that's possibly missing in other countries? Like they don't have our labor laws and our governing bodies that would be like, hey, you can't do that.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's very complicated. And so I can't speak to every country, and it's a, certainly a moving target, but I'll kind of classify this into two types of countries. And then the US is kind of a category of its own, because in some ways the first category is the global north. So we could think of Europe, Western Europe primarily being in that kind of category. Australia, some people would argue countries like Singapore or so on could also be put in there. So primarily English speaking, very quote unquote advanced, competitive, and so on. So there's certain features. People like John Oliver, I don't know what his name is. Oliver, I think, is the last name. He wrote a book called Affluenza. I might be misquoting the author's name, but he talks about these set of conditions that we create in the education system and the financial systems that put a lot of pressure on the citizens, especially youth, to perform, right? To be able to compete in this job market. So there's global North countries, and they have extracted historically for several hundred years, even though we think we're post-colonial. No, we are not. There is ongoing colonialism in so many places, i.e. the land theft from the indigenous, right? In Turtle Island in the US, the same in Australia, you know, and so on. And here we barely have any indigenous people in the same way left. Maybe if we look at the Sami tribe, First Nations people in Scandinavia, you know, but there's very few people left. That's the only lasting group here. So A, there's land theft, all of those things, the theft of land resources from the global south. And they're doing well. They can afford to have these labor laws in place because they've benefited from gender, racialized, and other types of discrimination that was created here in the global north. And so, and then there's the other side, which is the global south, which are the places we've historically been, exploiting to a degree. Land, the flora and fauna, the resources, the natural resources that might be in the ground, let's say mining or what have you, diamonds, you know, minerals, and so on, stripped of from the ground as if they were things, instead of an indigenous worldview that it is ours and it is ours, like we own it, but that they are also people, like their family, and we need to be respecting them as such. So those are the two categories. I think in the US, it feels like it's capitalism, a really far experiment of how much can we privatize, how much can we hurt our workforce. It's like the 2.0 version of capitalism from my experience. I lived there and observing it now. It's part of that kind of time of where it's kind of an experiment gone wrong, and it's perhaps in the stages of crumbling, to be honest.
Oh, goodness.
I'm sorry. Maybe you should hear me.
No, we're doing great. No, we're being honest and truthful. And I think people would really appreciate that rather than getting like fluff messages. You know, it's important to be honest and open with people. So I'm curious, what made you move from the US to the UK? When we talked earlier, for the longtime listeners know that I do like a little get to know you session with a podcast person, like, and they know we don't go through like, this is what I'm going to say, and then this is what you're going to say. Like, we don't do that here. We're open and honest again. So I know, for people who don't know, is that your parents were immigrants, and then you have immigrated to the UK. Mm-hmm. So like, what made you want to leave the US? I know there's probably a lot of things, but high level.
Yes. Well, part of it was understanding this in a big way, that my master's work was looking at how, my master's work is in English, in a smaller category of English called rhetoric, which is pretty much only studied Greek rhetoric, but in the US. So we studied people like Aristotle, but my advisor allowed me to look at other things. So I looked at the text of dance. So I looked at a South Indian temple dance, Bharatanatyam, and I looked at how did the British colonization, how did that shape identity? How did that change the rhetorical situation of dance over there? And in a very specific part, Telugu speaking parts of India, in a very specific time period, right? You know, we have to be pretty specific. So I wanted to continue that work. I mean, previously I was a teacher. I taught science. So my background's in science. I did this English, and then I came over to do my PhD in dance. So I was going to switch fields again and so on. And also in the work of doing my master's, I was understanding just how this was, and I think there was a part of me that was feeling more and more uncomfortable living on US land, in that it has been stolen, and that didn't sit right with me anymore. And, you know, I don't know if you have this experience for yourself, but I feel like going back to India, I don't necessarily fit in there. I'm clearly American, so people will comment on my cute American accent. So it makes it hard for me to actually be taken seriously there, and then not necessarily fitting in the US or the UK. So it's kind of like we're straddling multiple worlds. This is my experience as being an immigrant. So part of that was I needed something different. So I came here to do the PhD. I did not do the PhD, but I'm still doing the same work about how does colonialism and so on shape who we are.
No, I'll... like, ooh, a lot. Okay, so yes, definitely feel like, you know, as being like an American, you're easily picked out overseas because they're going to hear it and be like, where are you from? And then also not feeling like, well, if I went back to like where my people are from, I necessarily wouldn't fit in, because you got to look at it from a culture standpoint. I'm American by culture, most definitely. Mm-hmm. So shifting gears a little bit, like tell us more about what you do in the business. Let's say, like, I know you've talked about capitalism, you've talked about colonialism, like how this is your life work and you love it. You're living in the UK for the past 14 years, you said? Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're practically a citizen now.
I am. Yeah, I'm a citizen. I'm a dual citizen at this point. Yes. And so is my daughter. So, yeah. Oh. So I have lived here a lot. I still feel like it's not as warm and friendly a country in some ways as the US, And certainly we don't have the dialogue around racism and so on that we are able to have in the US, as difficult as it was to grow up and live in the US for those kinds of reasons. And I lived in Arizona, so a very conservative part of the world.
Red
in
state.
Some ways, right? So I certainly faced that. However, here we don't even have those preliminary discussions. It is kind of avoided at any, like nothing's being done either way, but we can't have the discussion. Most of us living outside of the US who are doing this kind of work kind of look to you all as role models of perhaps what it might look like in a couple decades for us here.
Wow. So like, where does your business like fit in this little, I guess it's like a paradigm now with all these different points? Like, where does it sit in like with people? And like, do you work like primarily online or do you work with people amongst the UK? Like, how does it work?
Yeah, I think I probably have a fairly global audience. A number of people are in the US or North American perspective, but I've had clients in Brazil, in India, in New Zealand, in Australia. Some African clients, some people across Europe and so on. But I would say the primary audience still is the US. And what I focus on is I try to do mostly online trainings, although I do some in-person things, mostly here locally. And the focus is ethical business, accessibility, and building inclusive culture. So these are the things, because my background of being neurodivergent, being a teacher, working with a lot of kids with disabilities, I've had a lot of experience with people with disabilities because I grew up in a household, multi-generation household, that many people did have neurodivergence or disabilities and so on. So I got really good at understanding that. I've had extensive training in that. And so I help people put those pieces into place. So some people might come see me about price. I want to make my price more accessible, or how can I make things more neurodivergent friendly? So.
No, that's great. And definitely needed, especially like we're in 2023 now, but there's still a lot of barriers, especially beyond race, like being neurodivergent or just anything along those lines. So let's say we have a professional come up. Well, let me back up. So would you say like with the accessibility things, are those, would you say they're like more systematic in business structure? And what are some ways that businesses can start their business practices better? Because I think a lot of people, like they take a blueprint from someone else with their business and they're like, oh, well, it worked for this person. I'm just going to do this. Like, what are some things that we can step in first to like dismantle that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't like the idea of just copying what other people are doing because it's trendy. That's not really my approach at all. I really want us to be personalized. So we can't always afford every bespoke solution where we can have it tailor-made for us, but we can certainly take something off the shelf and massage it for us, like make it fit us by getting good, like, right, we might get, I need to have all my trousers hemmed because I'm a short person. So that is something that I can be doing. Same with what we're talking, I'll focus on neurodivergence because otherwise there's so many areas, but a lot of the things we can start doing around neurodivergence is they're free. They are, it's really paradigm shifting work that needs to happen first. So when I would work, say like working with somebody about this, the place would be who's already, so we're imagine, I think the number one mistake is in the beginning is assuming that there's nobody in our community or nobody in our team that has these things. And 1 in 5 people has mental illness in the UK and 1 in 5 people has a disability. So, right. So we could just say 20% of the people already in our network are already having this. So let's be honest. I don't know a good statistic on neurodivergence, but I wouldn't be surprised if it is, you know, between 10 and 20% of the population. The second thing is around neurodivergence is we all seem to understand that to mean like that means autistic or ADHD. That's it. And I want to say neurodivergence is a lot more complicated. We can have things like dyslexia or dyscalculia or so on, which are more learning disabilities in a way. We have things like mental illness, like depression and anxiety are also create a type of neurodivergence in the brain. Complex trauma or trauma, PTSD, often creates a different type of neurotype, especially when it was in early childhood. And then, you know, so these are just a few, right? So there's different ways we're hardwired to think. And, you know, working with so many students when I was a teacher, or working with so many different people, sometimes when we make a ramp, like we think, okay, making a ramp is just for wheelchair users. But in fact, it helps people with strollers. It helps people with luggage. It helps people in walkers or needing a cane. It helps so many other people, children, people not steady on their feet, right? This sort of thing. If it's well made, it could help blind people, right? You know, so it can help so many different people if we're doing it correctly. Same when we slow down our communication. And here I'm speaking fast, of course, but that's an ADHD hallmark. Can't speak fast enough. But yeah, so if we can slow down our communication, or if we can allow people, like, and this intersects with so many other things, like in white supremacy culture, Tema Okun talks about this in her work, the formality of the written word. So we need memos, we need emails, we need everything documented, we need formal reports, but that excludes so many people from that conversation. So if we can say a regular check-in, or if we can bring in kind of more humanity to our regular meetings, like can't think of his name, Dan something or other. He's a CEO of an organization, I think in Seattle or somewhere in the Northwest. And he's really popular because he pays all his employees $70,000 a year, right? So he was
Dan Price.
Dan Price.
I know who you're talking about.
Yeah. So he does that. But, you know, there's a lot of unethical ways he's gone about it. I'm not going to, you know, be here to just explain that. But one of the things he does is he has meetings where he gets everyone into a plank position. So a kind of awkward position. And then he does the meeting. And this is so we have to talk fast in the meeting because no one wants to plank for too long. And it's like, mm-hmm. Is that an accessible way to think about it? Like making like, is the, like that's not fat positive in any way. It is not right friendly for a lot of disabled people to be in that kind of position and so on. What if instead we brought in space to grieve? Space to really connect. What if our communication didn't have to be always written and formal? Could it be like I allow clients to send me some of their pre-work as an audio file or as a video or so on? Like, can we challenge what kinds of ways are really the ways we can communicate? These are like, that doesn't cost anything really, but it's a shift in the way we go, moving slower. That doesn't cost anything. But it can make a huge difference to people.
No, I love that. That was really informative. So another question. I know I'm just full of questions today because I'm interested. Mm-hmm. So when we're talking about like office culture and stuff, like you just mentioned Dan Price, I knew there was some things going on in the background because I saw he was like subpoenaed or something, but I didn't know like what was going on. So when we're talking about office culture, like what is some good ways people can have boundaries? Because you know, like what was it last year with all the great resignation stuff, people saying, oh, I'm not going back to the office, I'll just quit and find another job. And with all that, like what are some ways like business people can start thinking about, you know, how can I improve my office culture? What is having good boundaries and such? Because I know a lot of people think that once you're in a job, you're available 24/7.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I want to think that there are some things we can do individually, but honestly, the places I would prefer people to explore first and foremost is the collective things we can be doing. Meaning, freaking the first place I would say, I don't know, is it all right to?
Yeah, cuss. Yes.
All right, cool. All right. Awesome. Well, then the first thing I would tell my kid or to other people is join a union, right? So that's like, this is important. The solidarity we can build by putting that money into labor dues and by collectivizing our work and giving ourselves a voice against the, you know, management and the organization that has a lot more resources. That is the, these are the things we must be doing to level the playing field. So first and foremost, I would have those conversations with other people that you're working with. Some places are not so pro-union. That makes sense. It's unfortunate. So maybe you have to lie low and do that work, but it can happen. And, you know, in some workplaces that I've been kind of watching and know insights about, I won't name any specific companies, that despite the company, like here in the UK, there has been strike after strike in the public sector, across the public sector, the NHS workers and so on. And by overwhelming majority, the posties, you know, everybody, 80, 90, 100%, you know, very high percentages of people saying we want to take strike action. And they're being out on the picket lines month after month. And it is, you know, at some point, and 400,000 strong strike just happened a few days ago in London. So, you know, this is happening across the country. And I think it is increasingly happening in the US. So that's one thing we can be doing. On a personal level, I think it really matters who your manager is or who the people around you are, right? And I think it has something to, you know, yes. I mean, when I was a teacher, there was certain schools that were a lot more supportive than others, right? So we want to find that good place. We want to go into the interview or we want to go into the culture and see what's what and be really honest about it. Talk to people, get clear, and having our own boundaries. What I suggest to business owners is creating an, and I would say this for people who are employed or self-employed or freelance as well, is having an internal document. This is not something I share with people, but I've written, what are my boundaries? What are my internal policies? And then I go amend that. And that, from that internal document, is how then I would partner with another business. I'm looking for certain things. If I'm going to hire someone, I'm looking, is that a good match to what I internally already had talked about when I'm looking at contracts or writing them? It's coming from that place. It is not just on a whim. That is kind of perhaps a little bit too, you know, systematic for people. It doesn't have to be super formal. It could just be some thoughts put in a Google document of just saying, I hated it when I had to work through my lunch. And that's my boundary. Like, make it a thing. Like, if I'm done at 5, then I don't want to have to touch my phone. And, you know, these kinds of things also matter when, if we're buying the equipment or if the employee buys the equipment, what are their policies? How can we be pushing back on them? What kind of support do we have from our boss or so on, right? So we need to weigh these things, but having the conversations, as difficult as they can be, especially early on, is going to be, I think, a good thing.
No, like, love. Thank you so much for sharing all of that. I know we're going to wrap up a little bit, but I have two questions for you. All right. So can you break down the difference between business and capitalism? I know a lot of the listeners are going to be like, it's the same to me. What do you mean it's different? So could you take a few minutes and break it apart? So, you know, people in their brains can begin to like, okay, I can see why this is different.
Mm-hmm. Well, some practical ways we can start to make a difference. If we're looking at all of these issues are interrelated. So for me to parse them is going to be difficult. And it's in the elite's best interest, or the kind of wealthier people's best interest, for us to be working so hard that we can't parse and can't see patterns and can't collectivize. So I want to say that's not, and there's a reason we're not being educated on these things, right? In a deep way. We're not told the truth about our history in a deep, true way, right? So I want to say that's part of the paradigm you're living in. So you might, where are the places you're starting to see holes that doesn't make sense? Start to pull those, start to find education pieces for you, right? That's where I would start to dismantle that. But an example is when we're talking about monoculture for food, right? So then that land is privatized. And then if we're talking about like quinoa, over that's a South American staple, and it's been so commoditized that people locally who would eat that as a main food, like in India, rice is a main food. What would, and this is happening with turmeric there, right? That it is becoming so popular because of turmeric milk or golden milk that it is now the some of the supply chains aren't as good. So they are adulterating some of that food, or the people who are local. I have not heard about turmeric not being available for local people, but I've certainly heard that for quinoa. So this is globalization, right? These are global issues. It's going to be a local, you know, thing we can hang our hat on, but it, the same process is happening. So we privatize the land. We then make these countries sell these items as cash crops, things like coffee, tea, and so on. So they can make money. The farmers can make money on that, but then they can't afford food like quinoa. They can't afford food that they would like to eat. And so that opens that market, you know, and then so there's a privatized piece, there's an exploitation piece, meaning the global south is eating itself to feed us or maintain our whims in the global north. And this is true, right? This is true, right? The same with disabled people, right? Not getting the support they need. So we see the level of extraction. So the tenants are the level of extraction. And I don't think, no, there's no such thing as pure commerce with no level of extraction anymore, but there's certain things that are less so. So caregiving work tends to be less extractive on the system, but it is extractive on a human being, right? So these care workers are NHS workers, are right, teachers not being paid properly, social workers not having the supports they need. So they end up giving that labor. A lot of housework is commoditized. So that might be the type of exploitation. And we see the breakdown pretty clearly in heterosexual couples, women doing the bulk of that work, right? So there's degrees of this exploitation you have to look. So that's a hallmark. The other piece is privatization. Who owns the land and who's owning the means of production? So, right, if we all got together and owned cooperatively, like I saw this, I think it was a coffee shop or something, they were going to, whatever the, you know, I want to pay you less, and the workers got mad, whatever the owner was going to do, not in good spirit. So the workers collectivized and they bought the coffee shop and they turned it into cooperative. So they all working owned it, they had a piece of that. So think about like cash registers, right? The self-checkout. This is a good example that we could have the self-checkouts, and then the people who are on staff who do the checkout thing, then that self-checkout is saving us the equivalent of 2 hours a day of labor. So you get 2 hours of labor a week free. You don't have, we get pay you for your time. You can go home. You could do something else you want. That's what they could be doing. The library checkout machines, with all the automation we have, that's what they could be doing. Is that what they're doing? No, they're going to go lay off people and make more people do, fewer people do more people's jobs. So these are hallmarks of how that exploitation, privatization and the who owns the means of machine, you know, the machines, the I can't think of the word, primitive accumulation. We're accumulating other people's labor.
I don't think I've ever like went into depth thinking about any of this, but I'm glad I am now with your explanation, because I'm like, you know what? I was like, I think back to, I was a teenager at this point, young teen, when the first kiosk popped up in McDonald's, and it was in California where the new wage law had passed. And I can't remember how much it went up to. And McDonald's was like, okay, minimum wage is up. Like, we added in 4 kiosks and they fired some people. And then like they did pay like 2 people up front that wage that they're supposed to. And I'm like, oh, that was wrong. Or like nowadays you go into Walmart or Sam's and there's just people standing around and there's like all these self-checkouts and there's like four or five registers open, if even on a good day. So it's like, man, now that I think about it. Mm-hmm. But last question. So with the podcast, we talk about finance, but not everything is finance related. We look at everything like such as your mindset, as your physical health, your mental health, just all along those things. So what are some things that we can do in our personal lives that can help us like shift our mindset to be more healthy? Because I know a lot of people may be in, they may not realize that they're in the unhealthy mindset because they're in a survival mode, or they're used to always struggling. So what are some words of wisdom you can give to those people?
Mm-hmm. There's practical things I can do that I can share, and I will mention them in a second. But I think the fundamental piece is shifting that mindset from transactional to relational. We are not hierarchically better than animals or the land. Right? We're not hierarchy. You're right. So really thinking about, can we disrupt that? Oh, I just know this person for what they can give me or so on. Right? We think about like landlords commodifying the home or the apartment, whatever they're renting, you know, that they're leasing to other people. Right? So it's that commodification piece. So the more we can build that muscle of communicating across conflict, about maintaining relationships, about building mutuality and solidarity, these are important skills now more than ever. And the things we can specifically do in that is we can do things like, you know, kitty parties or susus, like different ways. There's a lot of cool ways that our ancestors would have done to create wealth as a group, right? So susus and kitty parties are where people put in money and then they realize the money. So each person in turn, we're saving, we're putting money towards savings, but each month, one of those people gets the money, realizes the money for that time. So it's a quick way to be able to save, you know, or finding mutual aid groups. A lot of them started to spring up at the beginning of the pandemic, but a lot of them have faded just as quickly. But that idea of to each what they need and to each what they can give, right? So what do you need and going to that mutual aid group? And then what can you give? What can you put in skills? So there's time banking. There's, like I said, unions. There's so many avenues to explore these ways of sharing our resources.
No, I love it. So I think that is all the time we have for today. Is there anything else you want to add before we sign off?
Yeah. I mean, if people are interested in going deeper, I teach a course on this, sowing post-capitalist seeds. But even if you don't take the course, like I hear it's not necessarily a sales pitch. It's we really need to embrace something different because so many people of not just in my generation, but so many people in the world are thinking, oh, someone's going to save us. It's this one politician, or it's this one law, or it's this one thing. And I'm telling you, that's not likely going to happen, because anybody who is a strong contender in those ways, the media, the other machines are there to grind them up just as quickly, right? So that the chance that there's such a savior or one thing that's going to save us is not likely. What is going to save us is doing these work. Understand we've got to collectively, we have to do the work. There is no magic bullet someone can save us if we still have the mentality of, right, that we're extracting. Like if we still have that mindset, then it's going to happen. So really thinking about care, how can we create networks of care?
Thank you so much. And I'm going to put all of your information in the show notes if you want to share like where people can find you, like your website or email.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm at Anuradha Kautha or at the Kautha Constellation on Instagram and all the regular places. And if you're interested in the private work, as an organization or as a business, then it's thekautaconstellation.com. And if you're interested in that course I mentioned, it's sowingpostcapitalistseeds.com.
Thank you so much. And thank you for being a guest on the show. Everyone, make sure you check out the links and stuff that I'm going to put in the show notes. And that is all the time we have for today.
Thank you again for tuning in, and I'll catch you on the next episode.